Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the history of one of Judaism's most sacred texts that today is very little known. Most everyone has heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but of more importance to many scholars is the book known as the Crown, the Aleppo Codex, the definitive version of the Hebrew Bible. Written in the 10th century, the Codex has a history of diaspora much like the Jewish people. It was plundered in the siege of Jerusalem during the Crusades, ransomed to a scholar in Egypt, and held by a community of Syrian Jews for over 600 years. The story of how this book came to the state of Israel is one part mystery, one part history, and one part conspiracy. In 2008, reporter Maddie Friedman wrote a straightforward account of the Aleppo Codex, and over the next 4 years, he found that the true story of the document was far darker and murkier than the official history. He reveals that story in his book, The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. Maddie Friedman is currently a journalist with the Times of Israel, formerly worked for the Associated Press and the Jerusalem Report. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Maddie Friedman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Rich.
First of all, tell us about this book of the Hebrew Bible known as the Aleppo Codex. It's known as the Crown. Why is this so important?
The Aleppo Codex was written in the 10th century. It was completed around 930 AD, so about 1,100 years ago. And it was written to serve as the perfect version of the divine word in Hebrew, the authoritative version of the Hebrew Bible. And to understand why that's important, we have to go 1,000 years back before the writing of the Codex to around 70 AD, which was when the Second Temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by Roman legions. And until that time, Jewish people had lived in the same country and they'd spoken the same language and they'd answered to the same political leaders, and that's what kept them together. And after the destruction of the temple, the exile begins, and Jewish communities are scattered all over the world, and they get farther and farther away from their homeland in Judea. And they speak different languages, and they answer to different kings. And nonetheless, they have to be held together somehow. And what emerges is quite a revolutionary idea, which is that a scattered people can be held together by the written word, by a book that they're all going to read. That book is the Hebrew Bible. And for that to work, they all have to be reading precisely the same book, because any minute differences in the text could lead to a splintering of the faith, which would be fatal to the cause of keeping these people together. So you need an authoritative version of the whole Bible, an agreed-upon perfect version of the text that will tell everyone exactly what text they have to read.
I found
that book, which is the key to reading the Bible, is the Aleppo Codex.
And I found it was very interesting. Prior to the Aleppo Codex, there was a degree of oralness to, I guess, the various versions of the Hebrew Bible, that it was meant to be read orally, and that vowels and certain parts of the text were not actually there. It was an oral tradition.
That's right. I mean, originally the whole Bible was an oral tradition. And around 500 BC, we know that the stories had begun to be written down. And around the time of the destruction of the temple, we know that the books of the Bible existed in writing, more or less. But a lot of the information that is required to read the text was not written down. What do I mean? In Hebrew, words are written without vowels. And in the biblical text, there's no punctuation. You don't know where a sentence ends and the next sentence begins. Many words can be read in different ways because there are no vowels. If you take an English example, the word HT, is that word hit? Is it hat? Is it hate? Who knows? Mm-hmm. You need external information that tells you how to read those words. That information, even after the text was written down, was still passed down orally. And as the Jewish diaspora wore on over the centuries, as it became clear that this was a more or less permanent state of affairs, they understood that this information, too, needed to be written down. And it was written down in the Aleppo Codex.
And in fact, I guess most of the scholars who gathered to write this codex took place in Tiberias, around the year 1000, somewhere around there?
930 AD, the Codex was completed.
And if we can think of the connection to the Christian Bible, I mean, this is 600 years after the various councils in early the early church had basically settled on their Bible. Here, 600 years later, they're basically coming up with a definitive version of the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
What to include and what not?
Well, the question of which books would be included had been settled much earlier.
Oh, okay.
That had been settled by the time the temple was destroyed, more or less. Certain books were ruled unacceptable and were left out. Other books were included, 24 books, according to the way Jews traditionally count the books of the Bible, which is a bit different from the way Christians count those same books. What wasn't settled was more minute matters of pronunciation, of spelling. The text has to be chanted to a certain melody, which also serves as punctuation. That's very important. And all that needed to be settled and written down, because even those small, those seemingly small questions are very important in Jewish tradition, both for reasons that are rational, more or less, which I mentioned, which is that you can't have people reading different versions of the text, and for reasons that are more mystical. The idea is that the biblical text must be perfect because it is divine. And there is one Jewish tradition that says that the whole Torah, the five books of Moses, are one long version of the name of God, which is another way of telling us, do not get anything wrong. And there's a tradition of Jewish scholarship of interpreting the most minute details of the text, which is very different from the Christian tradition. In the New Testament, if you have, to take a random example, the word center, it doesn't matter if you write it C-E-N-T-E-R or C-E-N-T-R-E. What matters is the meaning of the word. But in the Hebrew Bible, those things are very important. You cannot decide on your own which way to spell it. Every vowel, every tiny vowel symbol is important. Every note, every symbol of punctuation, everything is part of the divine text, and nothing can be lost, even if we don't necessarily understand what it means.
Let me ask you, how did you come upon this story of the Codex, which I should mention, your book talks about the diaspora, it talks about the history of the book. This book is about three books in one, because there is a thriller aspect of this, because the book was in Aleppo at the time of the creation of Israel. The synagogue where it was housed was burned on the day that the UN basically decided to partition Palestine.
Right.
So there's a bit of thriller in this. How did you hear this story? And I guess the story, as you first heard it, was very straightforward, wasn't it? What you found, it was not so straightforward.
That's right. In the summer of 2008, I was a correspondent for the Jerusalem Bureau of the Associated Press, and I was looking for any kind of story that would allow me not to cover the intractable and circular Israel-Palestinian conflict, which was 90% of what I had to cover at the time. And I got into covering biblical archaeology. And in the summer of 2008, I was at Israel's National Museum in Jerusalem in a building that houses the Dead Sea Scrolls, a building called the Shrine of the Book. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are kept on the top floor. And I walked down stairs into a dark subterranean gallery, and in this gallery I found this manuscript which I had never heard of, and it was called the Aleppo Codex. And the story, as I understood it from the museum labels, was very interesting and fairly straightforward, and I wrote a pretty standard news feature about it, about 1,300 words. And the official story that I understood at that time, which is the story that was in circulation until now, until the publication of my book, which the story is that in 1947 there's a huge riot in Aleppo, as you mentioned, after the partition vote at the United Nations. The book is initially thought to have vanished, to have been burned in a fire. It turns out that that is not the case, that that was a lie that had been circulated by the leadership of the Aleppo Jewish community in order to get the Syrian authorities off the scent. The authorities wanted the Codex. And the Jews of Aleppo knew that, and they spread the story that the Codex had been burned in order to preserve it, and they hid it for a decade in a storeroom in one of the Aleppo bazaars. And in 1957, the Jews of Aleppo had largely left. They'd been pushed out of Aleppo, which is a story that was repeated across the Muslim world at that time. And the rabbis decided that they had to get the manuscript out before the community disappeared entirely. And they sent the book to Israel with a local merchant who had a very rare exit visa. And he hid it in his washing machine and smuggled it across the border into Turkey and brought it to Israel. and gave it to the president of Israel, to Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who was also a scholar. That's a pretty neat story. It's Judaism's most important book, and Ben Tzvi was the president of Israel at the time, so it kind of makes sense. But that story isn't true, as I found, and the real story is much more interesting and much dirtier.
Well, it's really interesting that this effort came together really as a result of the Crusades.
The Codex is completed around 930, and it ends up in the 11th century in Jerusalem, and it's held by a Jewish community in the walled city of Jerusalem in 1099, which is when the first Crusade shows up, and they sack Jerusalem. There's a very terrible battle in Jerusalem that pits the Crusaders, who are intent on redeeming the holy city and more than anything the Holy Sepulchre from Muslim control on one side, and the defenders of the city on the other, who are made up, interestingly, largely of Muslims, but also of Jews. There are Crusader chroniclers who describe the presence of Jewish defenders on the walls because they were Jews in the city and they participated in the defense of the city. The Crusaders slaughtered many of the residents of the city, and there are very gruesome accounts of exactly what happened in Jerusalem, and much property was destroyed and stolen. But they knew enough to preserve Hebrew books, because it was clear even back then that Jews would pay to get their books back. To understand why, we have to kind of remember what a book used to be. A book was an object that had been created possibly over a period of years, copied by hand by a scribe. In many cases, books included information that was irreplaceable. There were no copies necessarily. In the case of the Aleppo Codex, no copies existed of Judaism's greatest book. So if the book were ever lost, it was just lost. Jews of Cairo, which was the most prosperous and important Jewish community in the Middle East at that time, raised money and sent an envoy to redeem Jewish captives from the Crusaders and Hebrew books from the Crusaders. And one of the books they redeemed was the Aleppo Codex, which was not then called the Aleppo Codex because it hadn't reached Aleppo yet. It was redeemed and brought to Cairo, and that's where it ended up in the 12th century.
And this, again, starts the diaspora of this book, actually.
Right. It ends up in Cairo, and it ends up on the desk of one of the great scholars of medieval times, Maimonides, who's a Jewish philosopher and a physician. He's actually a physician in the court of Saladin. And the codex ends up on his desk, and he uses it. He declares it to be the authoritative version of the Bible, and he writes that explicitly in his most important work of Jewish law. And his stamp of approval turns the Aleppo Codex into the perfect version of the text, which is an importance that it preserves to this day. Maimonides' great grandson's grandson left Cairo at a time of political upheaval in Egypt and went north to Aleppo, which was an important trading city in Syria that was home to an ancient Jewish community, a community, by the way, that had been there centuries before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. He ends up in Aleppo. He brings with him a large portion of the library of Maimonides, and those books include the Codex. And from the 14th century, we have reports from travelers who pass through Aleppo who say, listen, the Jews of Aleppo have this great treasure, and the treasure is a book. It's the perfect copy of the Bible. And that's when the book becomes known as the Aleppo Codex, and it's kept protected by the Aleppo Jewish community for 600 years.
And it actually gets this name of the crown, too.
That's right. The Codex in Hebrew is known as the Crown of Aleppo, which is a name that tells us something about how important it is. There's a motif in Jewish tradition that links the Bible to royalty, to the King of Kings. Jews would be scattered across the world, and they wouldn't be ruled by the same king. Instead, they would have a book that would connect them to the authority of King of Kings. And if you go to a synagogue, you'll often see that the Torah scroll, which is taken out of the Ark three times a week on Monday and Thursday and on the Sabbath, the Torah scroll is often decorated with a silver crown. That's a fairly common motif in Judaism. And certain biblical manuscripts of particular importance became known as crowns of the Torah. And when you hear about the crown, it's referring to the Aleppo Codex, to the crown of Aleppo.
My guest today is Matty Friedman, a journalist who writes for the Times of Israel. His new book is titled The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. And it's a fascinating book that is a bit of a thriller. It's a great history. It tells about the diaspora and also how Jews prior to Israel's creation lived in many Islamic countries. That was something new to me. I knew there were Jewish quarters, but that even though there would be times of tension, they basically coexisted. In fact, one of the reasons Arab countries objected to the creation of Israel was because they knew those communities would end in their countries. It was really interesting.
Thank you. The story of the Jews of Islamic lands is a largely untold story, and it's quite an amazing story. 850,000 Jews who lived in Islamic countries were expelled from those countries beginning in the mid-20th century, and most of them ended up in Israel in a very ancient Jewish world, a Jewish world that not only predated the Jewish world of Europe, but it was a Jewish world that predated Islam by, in the case of Aleppo, 1,000 years. There were Jews in Aleppo for 1,000 years before the birth of Islam. So we think of them as Jews of Islamic countries, but in fact, many of these communities had been there long before. And this Jewish world, which was a very vibrant and Arabic-speaking, largely Arabic-speaking world, a world that existed in a kind of, it was far from idyllic, but it was a certain kind of coexistence that continued for many, many centuries. That whole world came to an end in the 20th century, including the Jewish world in Aleppo. And the story of the crown of Aleppo, the Aleppo Codex, is an interesting window onto that forgotten story.
In fact, this one of the things that led you that there was more to the story, because when these Jews from these now Islamic areas came to Israel, they were in part, as you write, treated somewhat shabbily, somewhat second class from the European people who had settled in Palestine and early Israel earlier. And the fact that the Aleppo Jews, for the most part, didn't really want to go to Israel. They were, if they could, they wanted to go to the New World, to America, or somewhere in the Americas. And this sort of opens a window into what really happened when the Aleppo Codex came to Israel.
There was, and remains to a lesser extent, but certainly in the early years of the state, great tension between the Israeli political establishment, which was largely European, which was largely secular and dominated by socialists, and between masses of Jews from the Arab world who had begun washing up in Israel immediately after independence, forced out of the Arab world, basically. The Aleppo Jews, most of them, some remained in Israel, but many of them continued west and established very successful communities in the New World, communities that to this day remain quite insular, very conscious that they are from Aleppo, and only a minority remained in the state of Israel. That tension between Jews of European descent and Jews of Middle Eastern descent has been one of the main themes of Israeli history since Israel's founding, and it remains an issue to this day. It is definitely an improvement. In the days when the Aleppo Codex arrived in Israel, there were few Middle Eastern Jews in any positions of power in Israel, and that's very much not the case today. But in the 1950s, which is the time when the Aleppo Codex arrived in the country, this is a time when Israel is very much a country run by European socialists and not by people from Aleppo. And that becomes an issue in the story of the Codex, because the Codex, in very interesting and complicated circumstances, which I detail at length in the book, becomes the property of the Israeli government.
And in fact, one of the things you found was there was a trial over the ownership of the Codex, because the Aleppo Jews who were in Israel said, we never intended to give it to the government. This is going to belong to us. It's our sacred document, not necessarily
That's right.
Israel's.
It was their most precious spiritual possession, and they could not quite understand at first how it had become property of the Israeli government. And there was a trial. The Aleppo Jews, who were a small Middle Eastern community, very much not part of the establishment, took the exceptional step of suing the government for ownership of the codex. And there's a fascinating trial, the transcripts of which have never been published before, that takes place over 4 years in Jerusalem. And technically what they're arguing about is what the courier who brought the codex to Israel was instructed to do with it upon arrival. And it was a more difficult question than it may seem, because there was no communication between Israel and Syria, so they couldn't contact the Aleppo rabbis who had sent the manuscript out to ask them what their instructions had been. But the trial was about a deeper question, which is about the nature of the state of Israel and Judaism in the 20th century. The position of the Israeli government was that indeed the Aleppo Jews had preserved this manuscript for 600 years, and they'd done a great job. Thank you very much. But now that the state of Israel has been founded, the state of Israel was the incarnation of Jewish history. It represented the Jewish people. And this book, the most important book in Judaism, in the Jewish world, had to be property of the Jewish state. It couldn't be the property of a small community that was going to keep it to itself. That was the position that was behind the government's legal position in the trial. And the position of the Aleppo Jews was quite different. The Aleppo Jews had not subsumed themselves into the Zionist narrative of Jewish history. They did not see the socialists, Europeans, who were running Israel at the time as representing Jewish history. They had never really seen Aleppo as exile. They'd been there for a very, very, very long time. And the book was theirs, and they wanted it back.
In fact, you write, the story of the Aleppo Codex given to the Israeli government sort of falls apart. It was taken by the government.
That is the case. That is the case. It was taken in a way that was quite sophisticated and very interesting, and which was subsequently concealed.
Yeah. And what's also interesting is that the Codex today has many missing sections.
That is the first mystery of the Codex is how it reached Israel. The second mystery is the mystery of its missing pages. And for Bible scholars and people who are interested in the text of the Hebrew Bible, these pages are the Holy Grail. When it was written in Tiberias in the 10th century, the manuscript had 500 parchment pages. The manuscript around the time it arrived in Israel was found to have 294 parchment pages. So about 200 pages had vanished. And these pages included the heart of the manuscript. They included the Torah, the five books of Moses, the most important part of any Bible manuscript. That part was gone, and other books were missing as well. Ecclesiastes, the book of Esther, the book of Daniel, some chunks from the middle of the manuscript and individual pages, about 40% of the manuscript all told. And the mystery of where those pages may be and how they went missing is a fascinating mystery connected to this manuscript.
And while 40% is missing, of course, the easy story is that during the riot, the book was brought out of the synagogue and destroyed by fire. And the story has been, part of it was destroyed by fire. You found that maybe is not necessarily the case.
Yeah, it's certainly not the case. That story is still in pretty wide circulation today, to the extent that people talk about the Aleppo Codex at all, which they don't do very much. But that's a story you'll hear pretty often, that the manuscript was damaged when the synagogue was burned, and that the missing pages were consumed by fire. That's a very convenient story, because then, of course, we don't have to investigate what happened to them. The Codex, when it arrived in Israel, was found to have a very, very unique brownish-purplish marks on the bottom outer corner of each page. And it was thought for many years that these were burn marks, that the manuscript had been singed in the fire, and that fire explained the disappearance of the pages. And in the 1980s, the manuscript was taken for restoration to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And a manuscript expert and a microbiologist ran a battery of tests on the manuscript, because the manuscript restoration expert thought that these burn marks looked funny. They didn't appear to him to be burn marks. And they ran some sophisticated tests on the manuscript, some of which were done here in the States in Albany, and found that these burn marks, in quotes, were actually fungus. that they weren't burn marks at all, and that in fact there was no sign whatsoever that the manuscript had been damaged by fire. And that revived the question of, you know, if the manuscript wasn't burnt, then where are 200 pages?
And we'll leave that for people who read the book, but what's interesting to me is how secretive this book always has been. It was secretive in Aleppo, and even now, you know, well after the establishment of Israel, this book is a pretty secret book. It's not shown off.
It's not very, it's surprisingly little known. I mean, in 2008, I heard about it for the first time, and it's Judaism's most important book. And in fact, one of the things that triggered my initial investigation into the manuscript was my surprise that I had never heard of Judaism's most important book. The manuscript is displayed at Israel's museum. When I started writing my book, there had been only one book ever published about the Aleppo Codex, and it was in Hebrew. Another book subsequently was published in English. But the complications in the story, the unpleasant aspects of the story of the Codex, I think convinced people who are in charge of the manuscript that it would be best not to tell the story of this manuscript. And that has helped keep this manuscript in relative anonymity, undeserved anonymity until now.
And I found it interesting that, you know, the Israeli president at the time knew that this was a very important book. He, as you write, he's a bit of the obsession about this book. And yet once they have control of the book, it sits in a filing cabinet for 13 years.
That's one of the great ironies of the story. The president, Ben Zvi, had been trying to obtain the book since 1943, at the height of World War II, long before he became president of Israel. And he sent envoys to Aleppo to try to convince the Aleppo elders to send the book to Jerusalem. When that failed, because of course the Aleppo elders were not willing to part with the book under any circumstances, he sent another envoy to ask them to allow photography. And he just wanted to photograph the book so that a copy would exist. They would not allow photography. He had been trying to get his hands on this book for years, and in 1957 the book arrived in Israel at the end of 1957, and by the beginning of 1958 it's in Ben Zvi's possession. And then there's the trial, and then Ben Zvi dies, and with the champion of the Codex gone, the Codex, as you mentioned, sits in a regular metal office filing cabinet for about a decade and a half. Before it is sent for restoration, and you know, now it's on display in Israel's National Museum. But that was not always the case. It was largely neglected and forgotten for many years.
Well, it's a wonderful thriller, and it's also a wonderful history. The name of the book is The Aleppo Codex. Maddie Friedman, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Journalist Maddie Friedman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book is titled The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.